conception of life, considers his body to be his self, and considers everything in relationship with the body to be his. Because he has this wrong conception of life, he is subjected to dualities like praise and chastisement. Purport by his divine grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Shivakam. Only when a conditioned soul accepts the body as himself does he feel the effects of chastisement or praise. Then he determines one person to be his enemy and another his friend. He wants to chastise the enemy and welcome the friend. This creation of friends and enemies is a result of one's bodily conception of life. Translation, please repeat. My dear King, the conditioned soul, being in the bodily conception of life, considers his soul to be his self, and considers everything in relationship with the body to be his. Because he has this wrong conception of life, he is subjected to dualities like praise and chastisement. Om Agnataramandasya Gunajana Saraka Chakshurimalitam Yena Tarisma Shudurvamana. In this chapter, explaining how the Supreme Lord is equal to everyone, and Shukadeva Goswami is answering Maharaj Pariksit's question about how, if the Supreme Lord is actually equal to everyone, it appears that he favors his devotees. In this chapter, Shukadeva Goswami is explaining how within the dimension of the three modes of material nature, the three modes are always competing for supremacy. And when Sattva-gun is prominent, then the demigods are infused with energy, and power, and potency, and success. When in the mode of passion is victorious, is exceeds the influence of the mode of goodness or the mode of ignorance, then the demigods flourish. And when the mode of ignorance is prominent, the yakshas and rakshasas flourish and are potent and infused with the energy of the particular mode in which they are born. But the Lord is not directly involved with the workings of the three modes of material nature. It's an automatic creation in which the living entities act according to their free will and are forced to accept the reactions of their actions. So when the actions come according to the living entity's actions performed by his own free will, the Lord is not directly involved in rewarding pious activities or punishing impious activities. It is all the automatic workings of the three modes of material nature under the jurisdiction of Durga, the wardeness of this prison house of material existence. So in the material world, certain modes of material nature, be they goodness, passion, or ignorance, seem to favor certain living entities. But the Lord is not involved directly in the three modes of material nature at all. And when some seem to flourish according to the predominance of the particular mode within which they function, it may seem to be partiality, favoritism of some or over others, but is really simply the reactions to their previous activities. And thus it is a living entity himself who makes or mars his own destiny. But in contrast, and superior to the three modes of material nature and the whole workings of the material cosmos, is the spiritual dimension. And aspiring devotees, treading the path back home, back to Godhead, leave the world of the three modes behind. And Krishna takes charge of their lives. He has to. Because one cannot become free of the influence of the three modes of material nature by his own endeavor. Because his own endeavor is within the dimension of the modes. And whatever action will simply create a reaction, but will not result in freedom from the three modes. Freedom from the three modes must be awarded by one who is himself free above and beyond the three modes of material nature. And therefore, devotees take to devotional service, leaving the three modes of material nature far behind. And the only way out of this web of material existence, in which every action, every move, simply results in further entanglement, is to take assistance, empowerment from above. And Krishna gives his assurance that for his devotees, who are always serving him in love, there will be no loss. Krishna says, I preserve what they have, and I carry what they lack. And Srila Prabhupada told one pastime of Arjunacharya, similar pastime with Jamunacharya, in which Arjunacharya was writing a commentary on Bhagavad Gita. And when he came to this verse where Krishna says, unto those who are so devoted that they worship me in love, I preserve what they have and carry what they lack. And Arjunacharya was contemplating, does this mean that Krishna personally takes charge of our lives, preserving what we have and carrying what they lack? Or does he just work through the three modes to preserve what we have and carry what they lack? So, in red ink, he crossed out that verse, Krishna's own words. And he was thinking that Krishna sends someone. He doesn't personally come to his devotees to preserve what they have and carry what they lack. He crossed out that verse, Krishna's own words. And then, as was his daily custom, he went out begging. But when he went out begging that day, he came back empty-handed. Everyone had some excuse not to give anything in alms. Either, oh, my father died and everything is, you know, I cannot give for 15 days. Or, I just spent all my money, or there's no boga, some excuse. His whole day was the result of his begging. He just came back empty-handed. Meanwhile, at his home, his wife was so impoverished that she could not even really cover herself properly. And when there was a knock on the door and a young, beautiful voice calling out, O wife of the Guru, she was attracted by the sweet sound of that melodious voice, and she wanted to open the door, but she couldn't because she had not sufficient clothing to properly cover herself. When a hand through the door handed a cloth, and she covered herself and opened the door, and found two very beautiful children. And on the shoulders of these very delicate, sweet young children were long bamboo poles, and on the ends of the poles were heavy pots filled with all kinds of bhoga, fruits, vegetables, grains, milk products. And she was astonished to see these young, beautiful, tender, delicate children, one darkish and one light in complexion, carrying these heavy loads, and she was shocked. So who has made you carry this heavy load? And they said, your husband. And she was shocked. She thought he was such a gentleman. But to overload these young children. And then they said, and when we were having difficulty, he beat us on the back. And they turned around and she saw red marks on their back. And she was just appalled by the thought that her husband could do such a thing. So these beautiful, sweet, gentle children carrying these heavy loads for her evokes such maternal bhav that she just forgot everything and she said, you come in and take prasadam. And she took the bhoga which they were carrying and prepared a feast and served those children. But they kept looking around. What's the matter? If your husband comes back, he might beat us again. She said, you just take prasadam and forget about him. And then they took prasadam and then left very quickly. And the Mataji sat down, ate their remnants, and while she was taking prasadam, her husband came back. And he was shocked to find that she was taking prasadam before him. Especially when he left the house with no bhoga and came back with no bhoga to even cook. And he was shocked. He was more shocked when his wife immediately started chastising him for coming home empty-handed and making those two delicate, gentle children carry the heavy load of his day's alms. And he, what are you talking about? He was completely bewildered. He didn't know what she was talking about. When he went to his desk and sat down and looked at the words in the Bhagavad Gita, which he had crossed out with his red pen, where Krishna says, unto those who worship me with devotion, always meditating on my transcendental form, I personally preserve what they have and carry what they lack. And he began to cry, thinking that by crossing out Krishna's words with his red ink and then just visualizing those red marks on the backs of those children, Krishna had indeed carried what he lacked personally. So when a devotee takes shelter of the internal potency of the Lord, the spiritual energy, the divine nature, to the degree he surrenders, he's no longer under control of the actions and reactions of the three modes of material nature. And therefore, as this verse is emphasizing, that one in the bodily conception of life considers everything in relationship to his body, and is therefore subjected to the dualities, like praise and chastisement, and the conceptions of friend and enemy. But Prahlad Maharaj told his father, Hiranyakashipu, that this conception of friends and enemies is all imagined by one in ignorance. And from that ignorance, we go on to imagine that Krishna is partial to some. He favors some and is disinclined towards others. But whatever punishment or reward is issued by the inferior or the divine nature is all ultimately for the benefit of the jivas. Because Krishna, like a loving father, having impartial love towards all his parts and parcels, is always acting for their welfare. And he encourages them to act properly and even gives incentives and rewards through material nature for non-devotees and through his own darshan, his own service to his devotees. And when his children misbehave and act in ways detrimental to their own and others' interest, he discourages that wrong behavior by small degrees of punishment until they learn their lesson. Whereas for the devotees, he takes personal charge of correcting that. But for the non-devotees, it's all enacted by his inferior energy, the modes of material nature. So, for a devotee, the Lord's hand working in his lives, in his life, is for the purpose of awakening his dormant love for Krishna. In the 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the most confidential knowledge, Srila Prabhupada makes an apparent contradiction. It's in the verse where Krishna says, "I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him." And Srila Prabhupada says, here Krishna is saying that he's not partial, but actually he is partial to his devotees. But this is not discrimination. It is natural. Yayatam mam prapadyante. As one surrenders unto Krishna, he rewards him accordingly with his own darshan, his own devotional service. So a more complete explanation is that Krishna actually is partial. But it's really a higher kind of reciprocation, not within the realm of material nature. Material nature is the realm which is under the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice. Whereas the spiritual realm is the realm of mercy. When the two overlap, the superior nature predominates over the inferior. So when the devotee is trying to become free from the influence of the three modes of material nature and learn how to serve under the divine energy, when there's an overlapping of the two, the inferior and the spiritual energy, the spiritual predominates. And therefore, when one is striving to tread the path back home, back to Godhead, and is taking shelter of the divine internal energy, if anyone tries to impede his progress, he will be vanquished, either by the modes or by the Lord himself, because the Lord protects what we have and preserves what we lack. And he takes special care for those who are trying to come home, to guide them and protect them on their path. And therefore, impeding someone's devotional service is likened to killing a Brahmin. Because killing a Brahmin is not necessarily murdering the physical body. It also means killing the brahminical propensities, which is the worst kind of violence, more so than destroying the body. Because it is destroying the spiritual hopes and aspirations. And therefore, the scriptures are very emphatic regarding obstructing someone's faith or spiritual progress. Just like the atonement given in the scriptures for hearing blasphemy of Vaishnavas. The atonement recommended, if you hear blasphemy of devotees, is to cut out the offender's tongue and commit suicide. But Srila Prabhupada said, for preaching purposes, we adjust this. Because if we cut out someone's tongue every time we hear blasphemy and then commit suicide, the preaching will be very much impeded. Because there probably won't be anybody left to preach, and the movement will be seen as more controversial than it already is. So therefore, in honor of the spirit of that text, we sometimes practice the alternative of immediately leaving, chanting the holy name of Vishnu for protection. But the best thing is just to defeat someone. Because if we try to judge or evaluate the devotees who are functioning under the internal divine energy, according to our three-dimensional empiric judgment, will inevitably commit offenses. And the worst offense is to blaspheme the devotees. And what is so serious and grave about this activity? Because our connection with the Lord is really based on our faith. Our relationship with the Lord is based on faith. And hearing blasphemy of great souls who have dedicated their lives to preaching the glories of the Lord has the psychological effect of diminishing our faith. In this way, destroying our spiritual life, which is the worst kind of violence. We do not fear demons with big horns and nails and weapons who can destroy the body, which is inevitably going to end anyway. But those who can destroy our faith, destroy our spiritual lives, are so much to be dreaded that Krishna himself takes charge of protecting his devotees and annihilating those who pose impediments on the path of his devotees. It's not favoritism, it's not partiality, it's just natural reciprocation of the soul. So, when we approach Krishna or his representative, the spiritual master, with love and faith and trust, he is naturally inspired to reveal the deepest secrets and intricacies of devotional service. That's what is inspiring Shukadeva Goswami to narrate the verses of this chapter. And that's also the inspiration for Shukadeva Goswami to give the details and the history and the underlying reasons why Kaliya, the very personification of the kind of poison of malice and envy, which is so prone to pollute the flow of love represented by the spiritual current of Jamuna in the hearts of the devotees, that Maharaj Pariksit wanted to know, why did Kaliya come to Vrindavan in the first place? Why did he leave his island in the sea, Ramanaka, to come to Vrindavan? And Shukadeva Goswami explained the history, which so much reveals the nature of the Lord's protection upon his surrendered souls and how he punishes those who try to impede the devotees on their path back home, back to Godhead, or their service to the Lord even when they are back home. So, Maharaj Pariksit wanted to know, why was it that Kaliya became so antagonistic to Garuda, which is Vaishnava Parag, Garuda, such a pure servant of Krishna, that he actually carries the Lord wherever he wants to go. And why was Kaliya so antagonistic towards him? And Shukadeva Goswami explained that on his previous, in his previous residence, Ramanaka Island in the sea, Garuda used to come and visit. And it is Garuda's legitimate dharma and diet to eat serpents. And what a blessing it would be for one embodied in that envious form, so conditioned to anger and envy and malice, to be eaten by Garuda and thus delivered from the bondage of material life. But the serpents were very disturbed that whenever Garuda appeared, somebody was going to get eaten. So they made a nice arrangement by which they would offer Garuda twice a month a nice vegetarian offering of fruits and roots. And Garuda would happily eat that offering. The serpents would make spiritual progress, and everyone lived peacefully until Kaliya became envious. Why should Garuda get this offering? Why not me? And then Kaliya began eating the offerings that were meant for Garuda. He was so envious. He could not tolerate sacrifice to that noble servant of Krishna, Sri Garuda. So he ate the offerings. And the residents of the island were so disturbed that when they told Garuda what's going on, and they were disturbed, they wanted Garuda to have his offerings. And Garuda was so angry with that miscreant Kaliya that he attacked him. And then with his golden wings was trying to strike. But Kaliya could not only bite and infect someone poisoned by his fangs, he could also like shoot the poison at a distance. And Garuda struck him with his golden wing and injured Kaliya so severely that he knew he was in terrible trouble. But he knew he had heard from the other serpents a story about a lake in the Jamuna, a very deep lake within the current of Jamuna, where Garuda could not come because of the previous episode of Shabari Muni. He lived there. Shabari Muni, a great yogi and sage, taking shelter in the current of Jamuna. And as is natural for saintly souls, he developed affection for the living entities who share their natural habitat, which for Shabari Muni was the fish. He became very affectionate to the fish. This is natural. Affection is a wonderful thing, unless and until it becomes antagonistic to the service of the Lord. So when Garuda came there, and nobody made him a nice vegetarian offering, and he was hungry, and he ate a fish, and Shabari Muni cursed him that if you ever come back here again, the way Shukadeva Goswami explains it, if you ever eat fish here again, you will die. But Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur gives a little bit more detail. His purport to that verse. He said, what Shabari Muni said to Garuda was, if you ever come back here again, you will die. If you come to eat fish, you will die immediately. But if you come under any conditions, you will gradually die. And this was an offense on three different dimensions, three different levels. First of all, he was ordering a superior. That's an offense. Secondly, he was obstructing the needs, the legitimate needs, and the pleasure of a great devotee, even to the extent of cursing him, under the mistaken conception that he was acting for the welfare of the fish. And thirdly, he was very inhospitable. Hospitality is so crucial to culture that even if an enemy comes, he should be treated with such kindness and affection that he will not suspect, he will not be suspicious that anything is wrong. So he was so inhospitable and angry with his guest. But the wonderful thing to understand is that his attempt to help the fish had an absolutely opposite effect. Because when he cursed Garuda that he couldn't come there, who came? Kali. And then all the fish died. Not only all the fish, all the vegetation, all the trees and bushes surrounding the whole area died because of the terrible venom and fire which is just boiling over from that lake. Except for one tree on the bank of Jamuna, which did not die because it had been touched by the nectar dropped by Garuda, knowing of what would happen in the future. So this is a wonderful thing to understand. Affection is a wonderful feeling. And affection naturally grows into attachment for those who work together in a spirit of similar devotion. Or even like-minded souls naturally develop attachment for one another. And this is good. As long as it does not violate the will of the Lord. And if that's the simple dividing line between proper attachment and improper. Whether it is conducive for the service of the Lord. Whether it is harmonious with the will of the Lord. So that Garuda could no longer come to the lake in Jamuna was antagonistic to the will of the Lord. The will of the Lord is that we all reciprocate with his love and devotional service. And therefore, violating that concept means aparad, which means antagonistic to Radha, the goddess of devotion, which results in devastating effects in our spiritual lives. So, Shobhari Muni's so-called compassion for the fish resulted in their complete destruction because it was antagonistic to the will of Krishna. When one offends a great Vaishnava, not only is that person destroyed spiritually, but everything around him, his whole surroundings are destroyed, and anyone in that surrounding. And therefore, the scriptures are so emphatic in warning us to avoid those who criticize the devotees and blaspheme those who have dedicated their lives to serving, to spreading the holy name of the Lord. The first most grievous offense, which we are warned to avoid any proximity with. So, when one's so-called compassion is divorced from the will of the Lord, then it verily creates chaos, and therefore everything dies within and around that lake, except for the serpents themselves, who were part of Kaliya's demoniac entourage. So, the effects of trying to evaluate with our empiric judgment based on our experience and understanding within the three modes, the actions of those who are infused with the divine energy is inevitably going to result in offense. And how does offense destroy our spiritual lives? It destroys our discrimination. We lose our discrimination. What does discrimination mean? What is spiritual and what is material? What is for our welfare and what is for our destruction? And therefore we see, in the case of Shobhari Muni, that by this threefold offense to the servant of the Lord, he lost all his discrimination. He lost all his intelligence, which is the ability to discriminate between material and spiritual. And his affection for the fish undue affection for the fish resulted in feeling a great attraction for what the fish were doing when they were coming together for the purpose of reproduction. And he was thinking, I also want to enjoy the facilities for reproduction. So he came out of Tamuna, meaning he forfeited the shelter of this, that divine goddess, Jamuna, of which he had previously attained shelter, the perfection of life. He lost. He came out of the Jamuna and walked to Mathura and went to the king, who he knew had 50 young and beautiful daughters of marriageable age. And he told the king, I want to marry at least one of your daughters. And the king told him, the princesses get to choose their own husband. So he went before the princesses, revealed his desire for marriage, and they were appalled, because Shivaramuni, having lived for so many years under the water, such a powerful mystic, he did not even need to breathe air. But he's all wrinkled and waterlogged and wet, and his hair was long and matted and gray, and he was appalling to look at. So the princesses, they could not be enthusiastic about the prospects of marrying such an appalling looking personality. So then he was not deterred in the least. He simply, by his mystic powers, transformed himself into a beautiful, young, prince-like, very passionate, very energetic, ambitious young man. And he came back to the queen's quarters, escorted by a messenger, and all 50 queens fell in love with him and began arguing. You know, the queens had gotten along all their lives. But when it came time to see who got to marry Shivaramuni, they started fighting. But it was temporarily solved by they all married Shivaramuni. But then they started fighting all the more about who was to be his favorite queen. So Shivaramuni, to pacify his 50 newlywed princesses, by his mystic potency, created such an opulent palace surrounded by so many beautiful parks and beautiful lakes and hundreds of thousands of servants and maidservants, just to pacify the queens, the princesses who were not getting along, and making Shivaramuni's life complete and perpetual hell. Until he finally suffered so extensively that he began to reflect, what am I doing? I was previously living in the current of that sacred Jamuna, the flow of the melted hearts of these servants to their Lord, and his melted heart due to affection for them, that sacred current. I had attained shelter, and I left and became so degraded that I could not control even the most base of instincts, the sexual passions. I've become disgraceful in the eyes of even ordinary people from my highly esteemed former perfection and transcendence. What went wrong? And he realized that I became attracted to the sexual affairs of the fish. And therefore, he concluded, let my life ultimately serve as a lesson to others not to become attracted to the lower modes of passion. And the association with those infused with those lower modes, if one seeks transcendence, he must seek the association of like-minded persons. But actually, Shivaramuni missed the point. His fall down was not due to seeing the sexual affairs of the fish and becoming attracted. Rather, that lower attraction and attachment was the consequence of his previous offense to a great servitor of the Lord, which resulted in his losing all discrimination, losing his intelligence, forgetting what is spiritual, and falling for what is material. So it is important to note how this cunning and malice and cruelty and deceit, which tends to poison the loving nature of the Brijavasis, has no shelter in the happy realm of Vrindavan. It has important significance that those who desire to create trouble and havoc for the devotees, to infect their hearts with malice, may actually meet some initial success, which emboldens them to attack even Krishna. Kaliya seemed to be successful in cursing Garuda to not ever create trouble for the fish. He seemed to have some initial success, and that heightened his ego. Or rather, Shabara Muni's initial offense was carried on by Kaliya, who went to such an extreme as to viciously attack even Krishna. So it appears that Krishna even allows his servitors to be subjected to the vicious assaults and attacks of envious souls. And why he does so is to allow his servitors to express their unflinching love for him, that even in the face of persecution and assault, they will continue their service. And ultimately, this is meant for the welfare of those who are envious of the servants of Godhead. By seeing the unending eternal love and sacrifice of the servitors for their Lord, and his unending care and protection for his servitors, that those who are envious will give up their envious ways and follow in the footsteps of the great devotees. It is interesting to note how offenders, even when they desist in their envy of the servants of Godhead, are not allowed residence in the eternally happy realm of Vrindavan. Even after Kaliya was trampled by Krishna, even after he surrendered to Krishna and praised Krishna and prayed to Krishna and rectified his envious ways, he was not allowed shelter in Vrindavan. Even after he had rectified his envious mentality and been purified by the touch of Krishna's lotus feet upon his hoods, his heads, he was still not allowed shelter in the eternally happy land of Vrindavan. He was banished back to his island in the sea. This is an important lesson. Of course, in Krishna Lila, everything ends in bliss. And even those who are barred from eternal shelter in Vrindavan are eligible for eternal residence in Navadvip Dham, the land of munificence. So, and that was signified after the deliverance of Kaliya. Everything in and around that lake blossomed in new life and new joy. A new hope. All the dead trees came back to life. Most of all, the cowherd boys who died when they drank the water came back to life. And Krishna, who initially appeared to be killed when that hideous thousand-headed monster just crushed him in his coils, accompanied by all his other hideous monster friends who just pounced upon Krishna. And the Brijavasis were practically dead from grief. Mother Jashoda was going to enter into the flaming waters to attain to whatever goal her son achieved. But the gopis forcibly restrained her and sustained her life by singing to her the beautiful pastimes of Krishna. And Nanda Maharaj and the coward men were then going to go into the fiery waters, but Balaram very smilingly stopped them and said, "Don't forget the words of Garga Muni, who said that many dangers and impediments will befall us, but your child will protect us from them all." And most of all, Garga Muni said, "Take good care of your child." And Balaram forbid them from entering the waters. I repeat, don't violate Garga Muni's words. He's the guru. To neglect, to fail to follow the instructions of the spiritual master is such an offense. So Balaram held back Nanda and the cowherd men. The gopis restrained Mother Jashoda. Everyone was just drenched with tears. But then, when Krishna emerged from the grips of Kalinga and delivered him by the dance of his lotus feet, trampling all his heads, extracting all the poison and bringing out the devotion within his dormant soul. And Krishna emerged from the waters, more beautiful, more effulgent, beautifully decorated with garlands of victory, and gold and jewels and gems, and the Kastuba jewel given by the Nagapatnis after it was lost in the terrible fight. It was like everybody's life was restored, not to the previous level of eternal knowledge and bliss, but even more exalted was their joy. To signify that even if devotees, due to some offense on the path of sadhana, or on the path of perfection, when Krishna places his devotees who desire some bhog, union with the Lord, but he places them in the fire of separation, that separation ultimately makes the reappearance of Krishna in their lives more beautiful, more meaningful, more vibrant, more fresh. And everything comes to life with more freshness and vibrance and jubilance than ever before. So this has relevance both to sadhana bhaktas and eternally liberated souls. That for the sadhana bhaktas, if due to some offense, we lose sight of Krishna, and we bring such suffering and ordeal into our lives, as explained by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that the offense to Vaishnavas is like a mad elephant which just tramples everything in the garden where we're trying to cultivate the Bhakti Lata Bija, tramples to the ground, and only weeds can be seen emerging thereafter. And meaning it brings so much havoc and trauma and disaster and destruction to our spiritual lives. But if a devotee is sincere, he will persevere. And for one who has committed offenses to devotees, the atonement is to beg forgiveness from the devotees we have offended. Beg forgiveness from the assembled devotees. Beg forgiveness from Guru and Krishna. And if we're sincere and persevere and rectify our consciousness, then Krishna will reappear more beautiful, fresh, vibrant than ever. And for the Brijavasis, the eternal residents of Vrindavan, Krishna nurtures their love by placing them in the fire of separation, which makes appreciation of Krishna's union so much more appreciated. And when he again returns, it is more infused with devotion and love than ever before. And that reunion is more precious because of the fear of imminent separation that it could happen again. So, and even Krishna's own dynasty, just to show how he's really impartial, although he is partial, appears contradictory. But all contradictions are reconciled in Krishna. Even his own dynasty, the Jadu dynasty, Krishna appeared superficially to relieve the earth from the burden of the unlimited military phalanxes, which were causing so much disturbance in his world, which he completed with the Battle of Kurukshetra, annihilating those offshoots of irreligion, Kaurava family, and establishing the Jadus as the rulers of this world. But then Krishna was looking ahead and thinking that when he leaves, the jatis themselves, in separation from Krishna, who knows what kind of havoc they will wreak in the world. So how to remove the last burden of Krishna's own beloved family members? Very interesting how Krishna removed them from this world. It was soon a fast. When the young princes like Samba and his friends of the Jadu dynasty succumbed to the offense known as the offense of childhood, the juvenile offense of immaturity in spiritual life, bred by what we know as familiarity breeding contempt. It doesn't have to breed contempt. Familiarity is a blessing in spiritual life. If it's always preserved and protected and nurtured with humility and service, it breeds love. But if there's any lacking in humility, an upsurge of pride and envy, then that very familiarity breeds contempt. So the young princes, friends of Samba, wanted to play a joke on the great sages like Narada, who had assembled in the house of Vasudeva. And they addressed Samba, being a very beautiful child, like a young Mataji, and putting a big pillow in his abdomen region, covering with a beautiful sari, taking before the sages, "O sages, who know past, present, and future, and omniscient visionaries, this young lady wants to know if her child will be a boy or a girl." And Narada Muni, omniscient as the arrogant princes established, was thinking, what will be the welfare of these arrogant princes? So he told them, it won't be a boy or a girl. It will be an iron club which will destroy you and your whole dynasty. They were shocked and fearful and ran away. And when they took off Samba's sari, sure enough, the pillow had transformed into an iron club. And the boy, so fearful, so repentant, went to Ugrasena, King Ugrasena, and confessed, this is what we did, and this is what came out. King Ugrasena was appalled. He said, grind it to just the most infinitesimal filings, which they did. But there was one piece that could not be ground down into filings. So they threw that one piece along with the filings into the sea. King Ugrasena himself. But the filings washed back and was sucked up into the reeds, which grew like sharpened swords and hardened clubs, and the one piece that could not be ground into filings was swallowed by a fish and caught and used by a jara to make into an arrowhead, which he used to pierce the body of what appeared to be a beautiful deer looking out from behind the foliage. But when he shot that arrow into the deer and went to retrieve the body, he found that beautiful appearance, like the face of a deer, was actually the lotus foot of Krishna. And then Hunter Jara, who was previously Bhrigu Muni, who committed a heinous offense of kicking Lord Vishnu in the chest, reaped the results of his previous test about the compassionate nature of the Lord. And he, along with all the jadus, who under the drunken stupor of drinking wine, took those reeds and started mock fighting and annihilated one another in a ghastly assemblage of carnage on the battlefield. And by this means, Krishna took his whole dynasty along with Jara, along with himself, back to the spiritual world. So, This chapter in Srimad Bhagavatam gives so many examples to explain how Krishna is impartial, even though we know that Krishna actually is partial to his devotees. But devotees is not any particular living entities. Krishna designed and expanded himself in the unlimited jivas so they could all become devotees. And whenever we claim that divine inheritance, we're considered to be devotees, and Krishna helps us. He becomes partial. But it's not to any particular jivas. It's to any jivas who surrender to him in love and devotion. And when they become friends to him, he becomes friend to them. And Krishna says, they are in me, and they are mine. And he takes special care to deliver them from the effects of the three modes of material nature and the judgments that we tend to breathe within the three modes regarding the transcendental nature of devotees and their interactions with Krishna. And he delivers them in the thaldrum of Maya. Personally, loving, caring, leads them home. So, we should, with all humility I command, take shelter at the lotus feet of the loving servants of Godhead, who are his agents in this world, who are the representatives of the holy name which we are chanting, representative of the holy name, we are meant to serve, to perfect our chanting. And if we've ever committed any offenses, we should beg from whoever and wherever to forgive us. And then Krishna will very lovingly restore us in his loving service. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
You recommend that the offenses
destinies are to Krishna. And we know that Krishna puts his devotees personally through various types of difficulties just to test their love. And their success is based on good fortune, which is mainly their association. So if someone has developed a critical attitude because of whatever, we should encourage him to forgive. Because if we develop a spirit of forgiveness, then and then begging forgiveness, forgiving whatever wrongs we have imagined have been perpetrated upon ourselves, and begging forgiveness from those we've offended, then our spiritual lives will be restored from the destruction of the mad elephant just trampling to oblivion everything in the garden. It may not be restored immediately, but in time, if we sincerely repent our mistakes, then Krishna's loving. He's just wanting that we correct our attitude. So if someone has succumbed to criticisms because of whatever. You mentioned management, poor management, bad management, which has burned in the individuals. But that's temporary. Whatever shortcomings in the management of the movement have temporary results. The benefits of the movement are eternal. So we should not forfeit the eternal benefits of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, Srila Prabhupada's ISKCON movement. We should not forfeit the eternal benefits because of some problem with the temporary mismanagement or mistakes. And if one has, you know, lost his discretion due to being too much hurt, we should encourage him not to perpetuate the pain. But acceptance and forgiveness ends the pain. And repentance shows Krishna that we're sorry for our own mistakes in response to others' mistakes. And when we rectify our mentality and just become appreciative for the good in others, because everyone is a combination of good qualities and faults. If we concentrate on the faults, that's what we're cultivating. Because thoughts are powerful. Consciousness is potency. Whatever we fill our consciousness with is what we're creating. So if we're filling our minds with thoughts of faults, that's what we're cultivating. So, forgiveness of others that we imagine have injured us, begging forgiveness from others who we have injured or criticized or offended, that stops the destructive tendency and makes us eligible for Krishna's mercy again to restore us and in good standing in the spiritual path. So for those who have succumbed to this disease of criticism, we should just encourage them that if you rectify that mentality, not necessarily by direct preaching, which could make matters worse depending on the individual, but by example, we're all subjected to, you know, the effects of faults and mistakes. If we take shelter of Krishna, he'll rectify everything. If we become, if our thoughts become filled with the mistakes and the hurts, we're going to destroy ourselves. Krishna never gives us more than we can handle. We add upon Krishna what gives us. We add upon what Krishna gives us and make it more than we can handle by our own thoughts and our own attitudes. But that's all corrected by gestures of forgiveness and contrition, which reestablishes us in Krishna's mercy. So we should encourage others, whether by our words or just by our example, to be tolerant. It's the foremost qualification for perfection of Chaitanya. Tolerance and forgiveness means that whatever mistakes, you don't take them so seriously because they're temporary. The results are temporary. The benefits are eternal. So, let's minimize the mistakes and faults. Let's maximize the eternal by humility, forbearance, tolerance, and forgiveness. By our words, if appropriate, if not, please, by our actions, let's encourage this attitude to help ourselves and others attain perfection. Action. Okay.
Related to the question. When we see somebody apparently doing something wrong, we discuss that. Does it constitute an offense?
No, not necessarily. Actual You know, what constitutes an actual offense is some envy or some pride. If we see that something is wrong, somebody's doing something wrong, and you naturally want to do something to correct the situation, you should. Just to ignore something that's wrong is not a devotional attitude. It's just ignorance. So when we see that something is wrong, you should want to correct it. It's how you go about it. When we see that something is wrong, that someone is wrong in their actions, first of all, we have to examine our own hearts and scrutinizing and examine our own hearts, our own motives. Is my approach to this wrong going to be beneficial? Is it going to help that person? Or am I reacting to some pride and envy in my own heart? Scrutinizing, examine our own hearts first. And then with intelligence and discretion, common sense, evaluate what will be the best means to correct what's wrong. What will be most beneficial for ourselves and others? And if someone is wrong, then whatever our approach should be infused with humility, wanting to serve the person and help the person in correcting whatever is wrong. That'll protect us and them and everyone from the disastrous effects of uprising, just by a humble desire to serve and help the situation for the welfare of all. And that usually means, practically speaking, going to someone who is in a position to help without becoming, you know, envious or proud, but who actually is a well-wisher to all parties and has the ability and the seniority or whatever it takes to actually help in the situation. So you mentioned discussion. Usually it means discussion. First, you know, the ego wants to broadcast the faults in others, which just maximizes the disastrous effects. The pure soul wants to correct the faults and uses the intelligence to decipher who is a person worthy of being able to actually help in the situation. And then in confidence, confidentiality, which is essential for trust, which is prerequisite to love and loving dealings, approach that person with confidence and say, I perceive a problem here. What can be done to improve and correct it? And then with all humility at our command, serving in such a way as whatever is wrong can be corrected for the pleasure of Krishna.
Where are they? Just there are shooting arrow. Is it necessary for Krishna to use this material body into a body?
It's not necessary, but he fulfills the desires of everyone. For atheists who want to think that Krishna is just an ordinary material creation like me, he fulfills their desire by giving nourishment to their misbelief to fulfill their desires. He doesn't have to, but he does, because he's like a desire tree fulfilling the desires of everyone. But ultimately, the whole ghastly scene of the Jadus killing one another was just like a dramatic performance, as was Krishna's being shot by a hunter. Because behind the scenes of the very expert dramatic performance, Krishna just escorted his dynasty back to the spiritual world. But he performed this scene, one, to show the disastrous effects of Vaishnava Aparad, and two, to leave behind a body to let the atheists continue in their misconceptions that they choose. This is the fulfilling desires of everyone. If one wants to believe that Krishna is just a material creation like you and me, it gives him reason to misbelieve. He doesn't want that. but he honors their misuse of their free will. Because without honoring free will, there cannot be love. And Krishna ultimately does everything to give us an opportunity to love. Anything else?
When I come to Vaishnava Star, you know, I call it Brahman qualities, he's taken it. And that's the sentence that you use.
But what was that?
You use the sentence. So the qualities, Brahman qualities, when you try to take care of Brahman qualities.
You try to impede someone's Brahminical propensities.
Right.
That is a subtle version of killing a Brahman. It's violence to the soul.
So, like,
that means your own qualities also. when you allow your mind to impede your own Brahminical propensities.
So, like, chakra, all the qualities of Brahmins. So we are trying to impede those qualities. Then that it constitutes in that sentence of service.
It's a subtle variation of killing a Brahman. Not a gross manifestation, not with the full ramifications, but it's a subtle variation of the same theme.
But not as we have passion, ignorance, toward this, and because the passion means protective. And you know, so though it is a spiritual thing, but it's a spiritual organization. And you have goals to achieve individually. And then what happens is, it sort of creates, you know, all these things, because the atmosphere is that, you know, your individual targets, individual goals.
This is the same thing we discussed previously. When you have the absolute and the relative coinciding, there's always going to be problems. But what to do when there's problems or difficulties? Take shelter of Krishna, try to purify your heart, serve with humility, and Krishna will take care of it. There's always complications when the absolute and the relative interact. Which has to be the case when you have a spiritual movement with, you know, an institution managed by imperfect souls. You have an interaction and an overlapping of the absolute and the relative, and there will be problems, guaranteed. Surrender to Krishna, he reconciles everything according to the degree of our humility and sincerity. So, thank you very much. Please forgive my offenses. All prayers to Sri
Prabhupada.
Oh, because I was looking for all over, I need to check the mail. Yeah, I need to check something. No,
I'm going to do my time. called last night. And just like my child was out, just like begging, literally begging, 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 begging,
begging, begging, begging, begging,
But I've already given him $9,000.
I said, tell him what he's got to do.
What he's got to do?
Get help.
Well, but he doesn't... I know, and I've said that. But I can't just keep giving him money.
I know.
He doesn't...
So just don't.
Just don't give it to
him.
He said he has a job.
It doesn't matter. He's just... You got to stop that syndrome. Clearly. Definitively. You got to cancel that tendency.
They heard you've been here for about 30 years.
33.
33. So you've read all the details.